For those of you that have been enjoying this walk through Ezra, Nehemiah, the bad news is that we've got today and one more preach before we finish the series. For those of you who've not been enjoying this preach on Ezra and Nehemiah, the good news is, or whichever way round you put it, the bad news is there are two more to come. We're just as a reminder of kind of where we are. Half of the children of the people that have accommodated themselves with the local culture, we're told, could no longer speak the language of Judah, but could only speak the language of Ashdod. And so they'd lost their connection because of that slow surrender to the local culture. And today, as Ruth and Kim have trailed, we're going to be talking about the wall. What happens when the wall goes up in the book of Nehemiah, so the second part of these two books that used to be one. So you might think, well, why does the wall need rebuilding? Because, like, by this stage, it's 150 years or so, 160 years or so before that Nebuchadnezzar has overcome Jerusalem. So you might think, well, that's a long time to live without a wall in those days. And although it's not told to us explicitly, if you go back to Ezra chapter 4 and verse 23, there is a clue given to us, which is an earlier complaint sent by local officials outside the Jewish family to the Persian king Artaxerxes. And it says, as soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, the secretary and their associates, these are the local people in Trans-Euphrates, the area in which Jerusalem finds itself, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. So I think we can imagine that there was an early attempt to build a wall. It was pretty well advanced, and it was then effectively kind of broken down by people that had beef, to use the modern parlance, against the people of God trying to reestablish themselves in Judah. And that really introduces us then to the person of Nehemiah. So Nehemiah is the third of the big characters that we get introduced to in this story. Zerubbabel, Joshua to an extent, who's associated with the rebuilding of the temple. Ezra with the kind of rebuilding of the people. And then Nehemiah, who's really associated with the rebuilding of the walls. He's sent there from the palace of the king in Susa, from the palace of the king Artaxerxes, who's And we see in chapter one that he, first of all, is very important. So we're told that he has the job of being cup holder to the king. That may not sound like a very important job to you, but if you live in a society where what's in the cup could quite easily and quite often was used to kill you, having somebody who's in a position of trust, who's holding and tasting that cup before they give it to you, is a really important role. It's a sommelier with added danger, I think you could describe it as in that sense. But often very, very important people in the kingdom, and they might be the equivalent of a prime minister. We can see as well in chapter one of Nehemiah that he's a very godly man. So most of chapter one actually is Nehemiah reflecting on the fact that the walls have been broken down and praying to God and acknowledging his and effectively Israel's status before God as people who've been in long-term constant rebellion and seeing a clear link between the long-term constant rebellion of God's people and the things that befall them, not in the way that God is punishing them, but that the further that we stray from God's path, the worse life tends to get. And so then he gets a commission from Artaxerxes in chapter two to go and do something about rebuilding the walls. And just before we move on, this is a longish introduction, but I think hopefully helpful and necessary. Thinking about walls. So walls back in those days had two purposes, really, maybe three purposes. But they decided who was on the inside and who was on the outside. So there was a delimiting kind of impact of walls. So to some extent, walls were to do with identity. What walls were also to do with was security. You know, if you're on the inside of a wall and all the gates get shut up at night, it means that wild animals, enemies, cannot come in and attack you and surprise you. The lions, which would have been roaming the countryside in those days, couldn't come in and carry off children or whatever it may be, but it gives you security. But the third thing that it gives you as well is more of an intangible thing, which is a sense of status. You had to be a certain kind of city. You had to be a city of some importance to have walls. Not every little two-bit village would have had walls surrounding it, but Jerusalem, in the absence of walls, also lacked, in terms of the external world, a sense of status and a sense of standing. So that's why it became important for Nehemiah. It was important in Nehemiah's eyes that these things got dealt with, mostly to do with the status of the city in God's eyes, or put another way around, the status of the city representing God in the eyes of those around it. So if we just move on for a slide, a quick Chris Whitty moment now. This is just kind of positions where we are in the story. So you can see we've moved the highlighted bit. We've moved right to the end of the story now. And we're in the kind of closing period of this whole story of Ezra and Nehemiah as we look at chapter six. So the king is Artaxerxes. He's the last of the kings that we see represented there. I've already said that Zerubbabel was right at the beginning involved in building up the temple. Ezra involved in building up the people. And Nehemiah comes originally with a specific mission to address the fact that there are no walls around Jerusalem and returns later in the story, right towards the end of the book of Nehemiah, as official governor. So he's on a mission, specific mission to start with, and he comes back as governor. And I hope that what we'll see as we get to the end of this, the description of this part of the book of Nehemiah, is that by the end of it all, there has been an achievement of protection, but there has not been an achievement of perfection. And one of the messages, I think, that comes out time and time again from the books of Ezra and Nehemiah is that God's people can be working earnestly in God's way, but there will never be full unanimity. There will always be people on the inside who possibly belong on the outside, and maybe people on the outside who possibly belong on the inside. And the nature of human endeavors is always to end in frustration. And that comes through time and time again in the book, as we'll hopefully see also as we go through chapter six. So that's where we are in the book. If we go on to the next slide, the story broadly that gets us to Nehemiah 6 is that Nehemiah is commissioned by God through his prayer in chapter 1 and by the king specifically in chapter 2 to go and get on with this thing. So he's got in a sense, like us, has a clear mandate that is recognized by the government around him to do his thing, to go and put his wall around God's people. But for him, as for us, it also, that does not make you immune from opposition. And we said that one of the recurring themes, and those of you that have taken time to read Ezra and Nehemiah will see that one of the recurring themes all the way through is that the local people and people inside the tent of Judah, people who are actually part of God's family, are in a state of regular, if not constant, opposition to the kind of building of God's people and the works of God's people. And so in chapter 6, we're introduced to three characters in particular. Right at the beginning, we're introduced to Sanballat, to Tobiah, and to Geshem the Arab. Now, they're just names to us, right? But it might help to think about this. You've got Jerusalem kind of here. To the north, you've got Samaria, and that's Sanballat. So to the north is Samaria, and Sanballat is the leader of the Samaritans. To the east, you've got Ammon, or what historically would have been Moab, today is broadly Jordan, and that is Tobiah. So Tobiah, who also from his name quite possibly is a Hebrew of some sort as well. So he's one of the people that kind of feels related to the people of God, but is clearly very opposed to what this particular people of God are doing. And then the other person that we're introduced to is Geshem the Arab. We're told that he's an Arab, and that kind of basically occupies the period, the area from sort of south of Jerusalem, right around the Sinai Peninsula. So what I've just described, bearing in mind that the sea is on the left-hand side, as it were, what I've just described is a people that are completely surrounded by people that wish that they weren't there, in one way, shape, or form. So everything that Nehemiah does and his people do is against this background, this constant bit of graffiti background of threat. Not just small threat, but existential threat. Everybody around them wants them to not be there. So that's the background. Then when we see the wall being built in chapter 3, and I'd encourage you to read it just as a kind of an in passing, it shows that the whole community, Nehemiah engages the whole community in this process of defining the boundary. One of the interesting things is that the people that are listed as involved in that process includes priests, it includes goldsmiths, it includes politicos, it includes farmers, it includes the daughters of Shalom. So we're told that it includes females as well as men doing this hard labor. And it's a period of time that where the people of God, as we see at the end, they complete this work in 52 days. The story jumps backwards and forwards a bit. But the people of God are incredibly effective when they're working together and harmonious, in a largely harmonious way. And the other thing, friends, that I just point out in passing is that there's one profession or one trade or one job description that's absent from that group of people who are building the wall, and that is builders. Not one time is a builder or a stonemason or any other kind of craftsman mentioned as being part of the group that are rebuilding the wall. And so, again, just as a passing thought, if you are sitting here thinking, oh, I should be getting involved in X or Y, or I'd love to be involved in X or Y in this church, but I don't have the skills. Well, try being a goldsmith and building a wall. I should imagine that they are not easily transferable skills. And so the encouragement of that bit of the Bible is that the heart that God can put into people when they face a particular challenge is substantial. In chapters 4, 5 and 6, we're kind of exposed to the leadership of Nehemiah as well. And what we can see from Nehemiah, and again, this might be something that we want to pray about, particularly as we think about a new leader for us. Characteristics of Nehemiah: he's decisive. He's faithful. His first instinct, as we see, as we're exposed to in chapter 6, just as an example, you know, when the opponents of the building try to frighten him by saying that they're about to start an insurrection, his response is, "But I prayed. Now strengthen my hands." right through the book of Nehemiah, we see that the first instinct of Nehemiah before taking any action is actually to pray, is to offer the activity up to God. He's prayerful. We also see that he's caring. So all the while that this is going on, we see that there have been bad practices breaking out amongst God's people as well, so that we see that there's been usury. You know, there's been lending of money from those with money to those without money. And then the application of really punitive or harsh terms on those loans as well. And Nehemiah kind of says in terms, well, what are you doing? These are your brothers and sisters. If we're here for anything as we're building this wall, it's to make sure that we're looking after one another. So one of the other characteristics of this leader, again, is about encouraging people to be caring and watching out for one another. The other thing that he is wise and watchful. And again, we might see that in a little bit more detail as we come on to chapter 6 in specific. But I guess the last thing that Nehemiah is, and again, something for us to be praying about, I think it struck me on the way through this, one of the characteristics of Ezra and Nehemiah is that the good leaders are aware of their own sin and they're aware of their own shortcomings before God. And I think that's one of the things that drives them to their knees in prayer before they start any endeavor. And I don't know if this is this, I kind of would vaguely recommend this book to you. It's a book called Faithful Leaders by Rico, something that I've been reading recently, but on the back of a number of problems with leadership and, you know, exploitative and abusive leadership inside parts of the church, not only in this country but around the world. It's just a review of what the Bible says that good leaders should be like. And it says this: church members are unlikely to be repentant unless their leaders are repentant. The pastor and theologian Jack Miller famously put it like this: if the pastor is not the chief repenter, the gospel becomes a theoretical solution for the theoretical problem of sin, for theoretical sinners, should there be any present. And it's a nice summary, isn't it, of how we can think about and talk about sin. And one of my jobs when I'm standing up here should be to be unequivocal in saying that I am not a terribly nice person. I might present in many ways as a perfectly acceptable human being, but the older I get and the deeper I dig, the more I know my heart, and the more I know that there is a problem. Fundamentally, I have a heart problem, not one that any cardiologist can fix, but one that the Almighty alone can fix. And that's one of the characteristics of Nehemiah. He realizes that he has a heart problem. So moving on to the next slide. What do we learn about them? And what do we learn about us? Well, one of the things that we learn is that we need to be willing. You know, I think the Apostle Peter tells us that we should always be prepared to give reason for the hope that we have, but we should do so with gentleness and respect. So we should always be willing to share why it is that we have hope. But when we're challenged from the world on the world's terms, using the world's agenda, using, as it were, the language of Ashdod, if they speak to us in Ashdodian and expect us to reply in Ashdodian, we should resist. And one of the things that happens to Nehemiah is this, you know, we think we've got a problem, say Geshem, Tobiah and Sanballat, and we need you to stop building your walls because it's going to be a problem for us. It's going to be a threat and affront to us. So come together. Let's come together on the plain of Ono and let's work it out. But Nehemiah's given this sense. We're not told explicitly that he's been given a sense from God, but he is clear that they're scheming to harm him. It tells us in verse 3. At the end of verse 2. So he sends messages to them with this reply: I'm carrying on a great project and cannot go down. I mean, carrying on a great project sounds like it's a bit prideful. I think the better translation was, I've got a lot of work on. I've got a lot of work on. So he just refuses to engage because he doesn't want to be speaking the language of Ashdod to Ashdodians, as it were. He wants to be speaking the language of Judah to those people that are working on the wall. What happens then? Well, the stakes are raised, aren't there? And this is when, it's still the world's pattern when they don't like something that we stand for. And, you know, each of us will have our own convictions about things that we should and shouldn't stand for. But I think that our convictions should emerge from the language of Judah, as represented in the good book, and not from absorbing the language of Ashdod. When that happens, we will individually and collectively should be prepared to be cast as the enemy. Jesus himself says, doesn't he, in this life there will be troubles. To an extent, if we don't find ourselves cast as the enemy, I'm not rejoicing in that exactly, nobody loves to be the enemy, but if we don't find ourselves cast as the enemy ever, we might usefully ask ourselves what is distinctive about us. And if the answer to that is nothing, then again, are we people that are fluent in Ashdodian and very, very weak in terms of our ability to speak the language of Judah? So he's effectively accused, isn't he, in verses 6 and 7. He's accused that he's going to launch insurrection. He's going to set up this new kingdom. Absolutely no basis in fact for that, as the rest of the book makes clear. He's going to set up this new kingdom. He's going to rebel against the king of Persia. And how does he reply to that? Does he give a point-by-point refutation to them in verse 8? Essentially says, you're nuts. You're nuts. I'm not even going to engage with it. Nothing like what you're saying is happening. You're just making it up out of your head. So I think being prepared to be cast as the enemy, but also not engaging on the enemy's terms, as it were, with that being cast as the enemy, is another important message that Nehemiah gives us. And then we see that he gets this opposition from within. We're told that he goes to the house of Shemaiah, and he gets given this message by this guy who's holding himself out to be a prophet. Let us meet in the house of God inside the temple. Let us close the temple doors because men are coming to kill you. By night, they are coming to kill you. And again, one of the challenges that they face, one of the challenges that we can face is that we feel overwhelmed, or some of our number will feel overwhelmed by the pressure from the outside world to conform. And so the pressure will come from within to say, let's the outside world is a very scary place. Let's make ourselves more like the outside world. Let's run away and make ourselves more like the outside world. Nehemiah responds in two ways. He responds in courage. He says, should a man like me run away? Should a man like me run away? If I genuinely believe in the God that's put me here, what am I doing running away from trouble? The second thing, though, that he responds with is humility, which might be lost unless we see it in context. He says, should one like me go into the temple to save his life? Now, the thing is, Nehemiah was not a priest, and it was only priests that were allowed actually into the inner sanctum of the temple. So one of the things that he's being encouraged to do, in a sense, is to undermine his own religious beliefs as an act of cowardice or accommodation. But he's saying, no, I'm not gonna go against God for the sake of saving my own skin. I'm not allowed in there. And in the old days, when God's presence dwelt there, if I'd have gone in there, that was a certain death sentence for me anyway. So I'm certainly not going to be running into the temple. So that's, in a sense, nothing unusual then and nothing unusual now. And we also get this patch towards the end of Nehemiah 6. The nobles of Judah are sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. Again, it's absolutely right that we should be in the world. Again, the Bible tells us, doesn't it, to say that we should be in the world but not of the world. We should not kind of cut ourselves off from the world around us. We should have concern for it. We should have particularly concern for its people, because they're all made in the image of God, as we are. Many of them are much nicer than you and I. Many of them are much nicer than you and I. But what we mustn't do is to confuse things that they've worked out with things that God has told us. Seems to be the message of here, because the external world will send prophets in amongst us. I'm using prophets with those kind of things around. We'll send prophets in amongst us to say that this is what the world thinks, and so we've got to get with the program. And again, I'd say to you, friends, speaking as somebody who spent most of their early years thinking that my job as a Christian was to get with the program, getting with the program in terms of being like the outside world leads neither to holiness, to joy, to happiness, and it most certainly does not lead to salvation. The only true path to salvation is to stay on the path that God has put us on. Something else that Nehemiah recognizes, and the way he recognizes it is, again, through time and time again, and we've already quoted from verse 9, "Now strengthen my hands," he prays. If you're looking for a short arrow prayer at any time, that's not a bad one to go for, is it? "Now strengthen my hands, Lord." So Nehemiah has trust, courage, humility. He refuses to react in the way his opponents desire. He remembers God is boss. And the result is that 1.7 miles of wall, 25 feet high, in pre-mechanization days, is completed in 52 days. So when God's people are faithful, when God's people are engaged, when God's people live in unity and unanimity, they can achieve remarkable things. But, and this is where we kind of bring it to an end, if we move on to the last slide. The truth is that Ezra and Nehemiah, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, tell us simultaneously an encouraging and dispiriting story. They have shafts of light that shine on individuals and groups of people in God's story who are faithful to God and who achieve amazing things. But they also tell us that that is not the norm. The norm is that we chose to wander off and go our own way. And as a consequence, the things that we achieve end up being much less than the things that we set out to achieve. Whoever has had a grand plan, please come and talk to me afterwards, because I want to learn your secret. Whoever has had a grand plan for life that has worked out precisely in every detail as you wished it would work out, or whoever has set off with great expectations only to end up feeling somewhere between slightly and extremely disappointed, I think the majority of us would be voting for the second rather than the first. So we see a temple, we see a people, and we see a wall. And in some ways, this is the spoiler alert for next week. We see that sacrifice is important. We see that holiness and a submission to scriptural authority is important. We see that in terms of our boundaries, having the right expectations, the right wisdom, the right discernment, the right submission under the Lord is important. But Ezra and Nehemiah